Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven, saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon, we are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is August 29th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for the next installment in the Jewish Revolutionary Series, Still More Jewish Marxist Revolution. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And it seems if we were just going to list Jewish Revolution after Jewish Revolution, we might be here until the Second Advent.
Well, that's right, because they've all been Jewish. And every revolution, I think, in European, and let me say pan European history, mm-hmm. except the American Revolution, was Jewish. It's the only one I could think of that wasn't Jewish.
They've all been Jewish-financed, Jewish-organized, Jewish-inspired, and Jewish-led from behind the scenes.
Well,
though.
I wouldn't call it inspired as much as I would call it instigated, yes.
Mm. Absolutely.
That there is no doubt.
Where did we leave off last week? Would you like to give a brief recap?
Well, we've seen the Nesta Webster has illustrated the hidden hand of the Jews operating through the Masonic lodges, mm-hmm. and the Jesuits, in the French Revolution, in the Revolution of 1848, in the Revolution of 1871, in the destruction of the old feudal order of Europe, and this actually it actually I believe worked to every advantage of the capitalists in breaking the feudal system, and at the same time the Jews were more or less forming capitalism, because capitalism is really a Jewish economic system, an economic system based on usury, which was absolutely foreign to our race before the advent of Jewish capitalism and the destruction of feudalism.
Absolutely.
And we've seen the Jews operate on both sides, and the end is to destroy the noble classes of Europe. And this is a war that began when Satan crawled. I believe that Satan began to crawl out of the pit in the 1500s with the De Medicis. And that's when the Catholic Church, the De Medicis were Jews that became popes, basically.
Sure. Well, didn't we cover that?
Well, right. And that's when the Catholic Church legitimized usury, and that empowered the Jew. And the result, the first result, was the French Revolution.
Yes, but there was a revolution in France in the 13th century, 12th century, wasn't there, where they had the same demands of the Illuminati, the abolition of marriage, the abolition of private property, the delegitimizing of the family as an institution?
Yes, there was, and it was short-lived. However, the philosophical building blocks of that revolution were lying dormant in France for some centuries until they were picked up, and they tried to place them on a new foundation with the French Revolution.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to start with Chapter 8, The Course of Anarchy. And this is in the aftermath of the 1871 revolution, and from Nesta Webster. Page 221. Although anarchy had been vanquished in the Internationale, it was anarchy, not state socialism, that after the revolution of 1871 obtained control of the revolutionary movement. Revolts against the Marxian autocracy of the Internationale, quote, the Marxist synagogue, unquote, as Bakunin described it, and Bakunin himself was an anarchist, right, broke out in Italy, Spain, Belgium, and the Jura Federation that had been organized by the expelled anarchists. But it was in Russia that anarchy found its natural home, where the ground had been prepared by the propaganda of the nihilists. Nihil means nothing in Latin. So I could imagine that the nihilists, that they want to create a desolation, right?
So basically, they're coming out of that Nietzsche school of thought, aren't they, some of the nihilists?
It seems to be. The propaganda, prepared by the propaganda of the nihilists, carried on indefatigably since the early 1860s. Romantic Russian writers are anxious to make us believe that nihilism, of which the name first appears in Turgenev's novel Fathers and Sons in 1861, was some kind of mystic creed indigenous to Russia. But to the readers of this book, the tenets of the nihilists, the hero of Turgenev's romance, the tenets of the nihilists will seem strangely familiar. Thus, for example, Bazarov, the hero of Turgenev's romance, explains that, quote, it is necessary above all to clear the ground, to tear down the entire social order. Later, when all institutions have been destroyed, when a tabula rasa is complete, a blank slate, then humanity will crystallize again in new institutions, which will no doubt be appropriate to surrounding conditions, no doubt ruled by Jews. The words have a reminiscent echo of Robard de Sedien's, quote, everything, yes, everything must be destroyed, since everything must be remade. That's the Jew trying to form man in his image.
Absolutely. Well, the Jew wants to destroy everything, but they don't plan on remaking anything. They just want to destroy everything and leave a desolation in its place. Maurice Samuel said, that they are destroyers and will remain destroyers because they want a world of their own?
I'm sorry, the words escaped me at least momentarily. What are those clay bodies that the Jews make?
Gollum.
Gollum, yes. They want to create a society of golems, right?
Absolutely. And wasn't the golem the mythical creature made by the chief rabbi in Prague? He made this clay creature, put a scroll in its mouth, and it came to life, and it killed anti-Semites, supposedly.
Well, it's a poor imitation of man, right? And today, through Monsanto and through Hollywood, the Jews have created hundreds of millions of golems. They're walking around our streets.
And they're all doing Barack Obama and
Sarah Palin. They go to tea parties and they call themselves neocons.
And they're all doing the bidding of the Jews.
The nihilist, Prince Kropotkin, informs us, quote, declared war upon what may be described as the conventional lies of civilized mankind. He refused to bow before any authority except that of reason, the Jewish religion, or one of them. Accordingly, he broke, of course, with the superstitions of his fathers, probably the Talmud, right? With regard to religion, whilst in the matter of social relations, he assumed a certain external roughness as a protest against conventional politeness. Art was involved in the same sweeping negation, the nihilist attitude being expressed in the words, quote, a pair of boots is more important than all your Madonnas and all your refined talks about Shakespeare.
Well, isn't that what the Jew would say about white culture?
Well, absolutely. They'll sacrifice their Torah for the complete destruction of Christendom, but they never give up the precepts that are in their oral traditions. The equality of the sexes was a fundamental doctrine of nihilism, which, as the Pere Deschamps points out, is only another expression for the destruction of family life. According to the nihilists, men and women live together in little groups where all is common. Oh, they're communists. In order to be wholly dependent, the woman must herself provide her livelihood. Okay, so they're liberators of women. So we see that the nihilists are absolutely Jewish inspired.
It sounds like 1960s USA.
It sounds like 1960s USA, but it also sounds like the Communist Manifesto and the Protocols of Zion. In order to be wholly independent, the woman must herself provide her livelihood. Maternity being an inequality of nature, the nihilist woman therefore willingly abandons her offspring. That is 1960s America. Above all, of course, religion must be destroyed.
Well, we should say white Christian religion.
Well, absolutely. And Stepniak, it's the only legitimate religion anyway. The rest of them are all Jewish shills. And Stepniak admiringly describes the campaign carried on by the band of enthusiastic propagandists who preached materialism throughout Russia, both in speech and print. Atheism excited people like a new religion. So did Elvis. The zealous went about, like veritable missionaries, in search of living souls in order to cleanse them from the abomination of Christianity.
And you notice almost every atheist is a Jew, and it seems all the Jews are atheists.
Well, yes, that is very close to being.
They don't need a god since they're their own god.
Yes, they are. Had not Anacharsis Klutz done likewise up to the very foot of the scaffold, what indeed is there in all of this but the resuscitated plan of Illuminism? And we've seen the exact same plan of the Illuminati before and after the French Revolution, right? Paredes Champs' suggestion that nihilism was simply the eastern branch of Bakunin's Alliance Social-Democratique modeled on Weishaupt's order goes less to the root of the matter than his further explanation that the youthful philosophers of Russia had gone to the fountainhead by studying at German universities with Jewish professors, I'm sure. Turgenev himself had spent 3 years in Berlin reading Hegelian philosophy. It was therefore directly from Germany that Illuminism, under its new name of nihilism, they only pulled a word switch, right? They jumbled the letters up.
In fact, it seems the Jew invented the modern university. Previously, the university would be somewhere where someone went to study scripture, possibly to study medicine, or they would study something along the lines of agriculture or some sort of useful skill.
The center of all universities before the advent of the Jewish power in Europe was scripture and the classics.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read the founding fathers of this country, you read their writing, you'll learn that they are very well schooled in Strabo, in Diodorus, in Herodotus, in Plutarch, and in Suetonius,
Plato and Aristotle.
Well, right. All of the Greek classical historians, the playwrights, and that's where the real learning is.
And today, universities don't have time for that because it might get in the way of sociology, revolutionary warfare, the precepts of Marxism.
Well, right. But if you study your Bible and study the classics, then all of these Jewish isms will become absolutely transparent. You'll be able to look through every one of them and see Satan, right?
Absolutely.
Well, once you have a good founding in the classics. In a classical education. That's what I would believe. And that's why the Jews are forever the enemy of classical education and have basically gotten rid of it totally in this country and in Europe.
And if it ends in an ISM, usually it's not good, is it?
Well, absolutely not. There's only one philosophy that for the white man, and that's Christianity. If it's not Christianity, then it's evil. Period. End of story. Okay. Had not Anacharsis Klutz done likewise up to the very foot of the scaffold? What indeed is there in all of this but the resuscitated plan of Illuminism? Paredes Champ's suggestion that nihilism was simply the eastern branch of Bakunin's Alliance Social-Democratique modeled on Weishaupt's order goes less to the root of the matter than his further explanation that the youthful philosophers of Russia had gone to the fountainhead by studying at German universities. Turgenev himself had spent 3 years in Berlin reading Hegelian philosophy. It was therefore directly from Germany that Illuminism, under its new name of nihilism, traveled to Russia. The very name itself had been foretold by Joseph de Maistre in the first years of the century when he declared that the doctrines of Illuminism would lead men to become Rainists.
Weren't those the original revolutionaries in 12th century France?
I'm sorry, I can't define that French word.
I think that was the name of the original revolutionaries in 12th century France that rose up demanding the abolition of property and marriage.
Well, maybe. Maybe you should make a note of it, right? Yet, if the seed was not indigenous to Russia, the soil was peculiarly adapted to its growth. The theory that, quote, civilization is all wrong, however preposterous when applied to Western Europe, had something to commend it in the case of Russia. There, civilization, consisting in a foreign veneer hastily applied to a rude natural surface, might appear to even non-anarchic minds, quote, all wrong, a process that needed redoing from the outset. It seems to me that Webster is accepting some of the propaganda concerning Tsarist Russia. Civilization, to be of any value, must be necessarily of slow growth, must moreover begin at the bottom, in the hearts, not in the manners of the people. England had her Alfred the Great, her Richard Coeur de Lion, Richard the Lionhearted, France her St. Louis, and her Henry the Fourth.
And you know, now they're trying to claim that Richard the Lionhearted was gay, aren't they?
Well, he absolutely wasn't. I mean, that's revisionist. That the fags looked for men who weren't prolifically married, and they try to make them gay like them to legitimize their own sexual deviancy.
Sure, and he spent most of his life on the battlefield.
They try to say Abraham Lincoln was gay too. That's why they call themselves the sexual deviants in the Republican Party. That's why they call themselves log cabin Republicans.
And it even says here on your Wikipedia that before 1948, no historian ever alleged that Richard the Lionhearted was homosexual, and it's basically all modern.
And well, like I said, the sexual deviants look for figures in history that they could accuse of sexual deviancy in order to embrace, in order to get us to accept their deviancy, because they want to give it the appearance of legitimacy, right?
Sure, and if all our historical heroes were queers, well, why shouldn't we be queers? Or at least
well exactly. Then why shouldn't we accept them? Civilization, to be of any value, must necessarily be of slow growth, must moreover begin at the bottom. Well, let me get, there's two Greek words for law, right? There's nomos, and that's the law of the land, and there's ethos, and ethos is the law that comes from the custom of the people. And if I'm not mistaken, the way I read that is that nomos is more or less imposed on a people by a king, but ethos comes from the hearts of the people. And it's not a mistake that word is very close to ethnos. And nomos is actually, it's actually from a word that means pasture. Nomos actually means a pasture, and that's the law of the land. Russia had never known these early influences. Founded on Tartar instead of Roman ideas, I think that's a little stretching it. She had remained sunk in barbarism until Peter the Great began his veneering process, which, applied to the rude surface of Russian life, resulted in a form of culture both premature and unnatural. To change the simile, such civilization in Russia had attained in the 19th century was not the natural growth of the soil. It was a German civilization wholly foreign to the genius of her people. There was much, and by genius she means the, not that the people are excelled intellectually, but she means by genius the inner conscious and social consciousness of the people, I believe, is the way to read that there. There was much that was good and wholesome in the life of the Russian peasants. De Custine declared that it was worth coming to Russia only to see the pure image of patriarchal society and what the quote-unquote celestial faces of the old peasants seated with dignity at the end of the day before the thresholds of their cottages. One must go into the interior of Russia to know what primitive man was worth, and all that the refinements of society have made him lose. The noble savage theory applied to whites. I have said, and I repeat it, in this patriarchal country, it is civilization that spoils man.
And that's what a Jew would say.
Yes.
When it's the Jew that spoils man.
Well, they don't understand. The Jew does not understand the patriarchal society, so he demonizes it. And that alone should be proof that those Israelites of the Old Testament couldn't possibly have been Jews, because the Jew, all through history, has demonized the patriarchal society, and yet he claims to have descended from one? Tell me that's not the biggest the biggest hypocrisy ever.
So they basically crap on the patriarchy, but they claim to have descended from the biblical patriarchs through David.
Well, the Old Testament culture and society was an agrarian patriarchal society.
And the Jews have never farmed a day in their lives, have they?
It's always been the antithesis to the Jew. And the Jew has always detested it. So how could we think that the Jew could have descended from those people?
I mean, if the Bible were... It's
an oxymoron. It can't be done.
If the Bible were about Jews, David would have been a slave-peddling merchant man, and he probably would have been running pyramid scams back then, sending people tablets saying, scratch your name out and write your so-and-so's name at the top and mail, five shekels to so-and-so.
Well, right. They'd have gone everywhere with the style of scribes and not swords. I mean, the word sword probably wouldn't be in there unless the Jew could make money selling them to the goy. The Bible would be an economic book. It would be a book about banking.
It'd be like that Ferengi, the Rules of Acquisition from Star Trek.
Well, the bottom line is that there's no way that the patriarchal society could produce the Jew. The same people that believe that are the simple-minded people that believe that Noah could have sons of three different races. It's all Jewish myths and fables.
How could anyone believe that? I've actually heard people say that Noah had all the DNA of all the races in him.
Well, that would make Noah a chimera, right?
Noah would have looked like Barack Obama and Tiger Woods on steroids then, wouldn't he?
Okay. It is easy then to understand how the quote-unquote illuminated doctrine of a return to nature, and we saw that in France also, right, with Rousseau, might find an echo in the least anarchic minds when applied to Russia. And if it had been only this foreign and artificial civilization the nihilists had set out to destroy, who could have blamed them? If, further, they had had anything better to offer in its place, who could have failed to applaud them? But the tragedy of Russia is never to have been allowed to develop along her own national lines. She had been made by the Romanovs to imitate Western civilization. Now she was to be taught by the revolutionaries to imitate Western methods of overthrowing it. I would have to contest that. Yet, the Rus were a Germanic tribe and the ruling class of Russia at the invitation of the Slavs. The Greeks had civilized and Christianized Slavic Russia 8 centuries before the Romanovs.
Sure, and most of the Russian leaders, they were all Germans from the various German states, weren't they?
Well, and that's what Nesta Webster is pointing out. But the Western influence on the Slavs of Russia, it is a lot older than that. I mean, it goes back to the 8th, 9th centuries.
Didn't they call Moscow the Third Rome?
Well, Moscow was the Third Rome. I believe it was. There's an excellent book, and he's oversympathetic to the Russian Orthodox Church, but I can sympathize with, I can feel empathy for that. And his name is Michael Raphael Johnson. He's the former editor of the Barnes Review. He's the last decent editor of the Barnes Review. And he wrote this book, The Third Rome, which is all about Tsarist Russia and how civilized it was. And the high level of culture that was attained under the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia, and it had a moralizing and civilizing influence on the agrarian tribes of the steppe, and I don't have a problem with that. They were originally white Slavic people, and they probably did need to be Christianized, but I don't see where Nesta Webster is entirely correct here in attributing the civilizing of Russia to the artificial civilization of the German nobles grafted on top of a barbaric Russia, which is more or less the portrait she's drawing here. Mm-hmm. And I think the truth is somewhere far in between.
And Russia today is probably not this great white hope that all the secular white nationalists want to portray it as. Wouldn't you agree?
That's absolutely true, because the Jews are controlling Russia just like they're controlling China, just like they're controlling America. And if we think otherwise, we are fools. The news that we get on mainstream media and in the United States about Russia is the news that the Jew wants us to have, period. And Russia is not a model for white nationalism. And the proof of that is that when the Yeltsin government came to power and the Gorbachev government disintegrated, who ended up with all the wealth of Russia?
All the Jews.
Who holds it now?
All the Jews.
They still hold it, don't they?
So they just took off their communist jackets and put on capitalist jackets.
So who is Putin working for if the
Jews
still hold the wealth of Russia?
Well, if he wasn't working for the Jews, he'd be dead.
Well, right. That's the bottom line. If Putin was really the great white hero that the silly American white nationalists make him out to be, then Putin would have corrected the thieving by the Jews that went on when they looted and pillaged all of the Russian industry that formerly belonged to the state and therefore to the people in the Yeltsin administration.
And additionally,
Putin would have corrected that. He never moved to correct that. He only eliminated one oligarch who was a political opponent, and that was convenient for him to do.
Also, he wouldn't allow the Russian women to be peddled like, you know, cattle, would he?
Well, they're still being peddled like cattle, and there may as well be cattle trains of Russian women from the Ukraine to Tel Aviv. And Russian children. And Ukrainian women and children.
And he must know about that, wouldn't you say?
He absolutely has to know about that. I mean, he did come out of the KGB, right?
He was.
He should know a little bit about intelligence, right?
Yes.
If we know about it, he should know about it, I imagine.
I think he was in the FSB. That was the post-Soviet KGB. He was in the KGB, and then I think later the FSB.
Well, if you want the proof of that, just trip over a porno site on the internet or get some porno spam on your forum, because they're all blondes and they're all clearly Eastern European blondes.
Mm.
And the Jews are using the Eastern European white women as the fodder for the porno industry. And Putin's got to be just as responsible for it than the Jews. And Putin's just a shill for the Jew. And all of these white nationalists that look for a savior in Russia are absolutely naive. The savior that they should be looking for is in Christ.
He spent
period.
16 years in the KGB.
He's a shill for the Jew, just like Yeltsin was, just like Gorbachev was, just like the last 20 American presidents were. There's no difference. Anybody who thinks otherwise is kidding themselves. Okay, where was I? It is easy to understand how the illuminated doctrine of a nature of a return to nature might find an echo in the least anarchic minds when applied to Russia. And if it had been only this foreign and artificial civilization the nihilists had set out to destroy, who could have blamed them? If further they had anything better to offer in its place, who could have failed to applaud them? But the tragedy of Russia is never to have been allowed to develop along her own national lines. She had been made by the Romanovs to imitate Western civilization. Now she was taught by the revolutionaries to imitate Western methods of overthrowing it. I wouldn't think that Judaism is a Western method of overthrowing civilization. Bakunin had raged against the German Petersbourgeois imperialism, and it was German Illuminism his followers brought to Russia in its stead. The tendency to anarchy latent in the Russian nature, as exemplified in the Baron Ungern von Sternberg, well, he was a German, was to be exploited in the interests of world revolution. And that's an example of Nesta Webster consistently confusing geography and genealogy. Baron Ungern von Sternberg was not Russian. He was Prussian. For in spite of the serenity described by de Custine as characteristic of the Russian peasant in his normal moments, he responds only too readily to suggestions of violence. let me say that Baron von Sternberg was a Russian ruler, but he was Prussian by race. And when we consider this peculiarity, when we remember the tendency to drunkenness and to brutality that underlies his surface impassiveness, we realize the fearful danger of taking from him the only restraints he knew, respect for God and the Tsar. Was the imperial government then to tolerate the campaign of insubordination and of militant atheism conducted by the nihilists from 1866 onwards? Now let me say something. What, wasn't it in like 1862 or 63 that the Tsar sent his fleet to stop, to blockade the English and the French from interfering in the American Civil War?
Absolutely, yes.
So is this, with the nihilists campaigning for the overthrow of imperial government in Russia from 1866, that is really awfully close to sounding like Rothschild-inspired retribution.
They didn't need the Tsar anymore.
Well, no, but he...
Oh, I'm sorry. They were getting back at him because he stepped on the feet of the British and the French.
I wonder if Nesta Webster's going to imagine that. Can it be seriously maintained that any government would have been doing its duty if it had not protected the simple peasantry from these disintegrating doctrines? What could it do but arrest, imprison, exile, and suppress by all means in its power the germ carriers who would have infected the whole life of the people? If the methods adopted resembled those of Eastern potentates rather than those of our own enlightened legislators, it must be remembered that the rulers of Russia can no more than their subjects be judged by Western standards. Moreover, without condoning the brutality of the repression exercised, it must be recognized that a reverse du medaillon exists. Let's put ourselves in the place of Nicholas I, who has been persistently represented as an intractable autocrat, by Jews, I'm sure, ascending the throne with the warning of the French Revolution ringing in his ears. He found himself immediately confronted by the Decabrist outbreak, obviously engineered by secret forces, an experience that left a deep impression on his mind. Yet, in spite of this, have we not seen him visiting Robert Owen at the New Lanark and in 1839 receiving deputations of serfs, begging to be transferred to the royal domains, assuring them, moreover, of his desire for their emancipation. Alas, with what fatal results? No wonder then we find him declaring, quote, "Despotism exists in Russia since it is the essence of my government, but it is in accord with the genius of the nation, the mentality of the nation." 300 years earlier, the Austrian ambassador to Moscow had asked whether it was the character of the Russian nation that had made autocrats, or autocrats that had made the character of the Russian nation. And de Custine, echoing the question in 1839, gives as his opinion, quote, "If the iron rod that directs this still brutalized people were to cease for an instant to weigh on it, the whole of society would be overthrown." We have only to study the history of Russia throughout the 19th century to realize that every step towards reform became the signal for a fresh outbreak of revolutionary agitation.
Certainly, nothing ever pleased them. Am I right or am I wrong?
No reform ever pleases the Jew. He wants to move on to the next revolution.
You can't make a compromise with Satan.
Until there is nothing left. The nihilist movement followed directly on the era of reform inaugurated by Alexander II. The emancipation of the serfs in 1861 did nothing to allay agitation, and if, as we are assured, the measure failed to satisfy the peasants, we must at least recognize the sincerity of the emperor's intentions. To turn against him at this juncture was naturally to drive him into reaction and to arrest the whole movement of reform. It cannot be too often repeated, violence begets violence, and if we are to see in nihilism the outcome of repression, as truly we must recognize in so-called czarism, the result of agitation, The revolutionaries plotted secretly against the state, and the state defended itself by the secret methods of the quote-unquote third section. The authorities forbade the circulation of seditious pamphlets, the Jewish propaganda ploy, and the traffickers in forbidden literature redoubled their efforts to smuggle it into the country. Each side pitted its wits against the other, and thus the vicious circle once created could not be arrested. It seems to me that the Russian peasants were not the illiterate barbarians that they're made out to be. If the Jews were so interested in winning their hearts with literature, they must have been able to read, right? I mean, they must have taken that for granted, right?
Otherwise, they would have just pushed porno on them.
Well, absolutely.
Since, you know, educated people aren't going to really be interested in porn, they'll be interested in literature.
It was not, however, until after 1871 that the Russian revolutionary movement entered on its violent phases. The example of the Paris Commune then spread eastwards, and the revolutionaries, no longer known as nihilists, but, quote, revolutionary socialists, embarked on a series of outrages which marked the years 1873 to 1881. Now we saw from Raphael Johnson just before we covered the Russian number one report, I had quoted a couple of chapters, I think, from Raphael Johnson, The Third Rome, that talked about the high level of industry and production in Russia at this time. And surprisingly, Nesta Webster really hasn't touched on that at all so far. To continue, much has been written about the heroism, the self-sacrifice, the burning enthusiasm of the, quote, Tchaikovsky Circle that was inaugurated toward the end of 1872 at St. Petersburg, with ramifications at Moscow and other large towns of Russia. This little band of propagandists that consisted solely of upper and middle class intellectuals certainly showed themselves capable of great courage and endurance when the movement passed from words to deeds. But at the outset, it is evident from the accounts given by the members themselves that they derived no small amount of enjoyment from the novelty and excitement the new life provided. One must know something of the Russian character from personal experience to understand this. To the Russian, intrigue, particularly of the political variety, is as the breath of life. And we have already seen how to Bakunin, who was a Russian anarchist, moved west. The preparing of revolution, the secret signs and codes, chemical inks, all-night discussions over tea and cigarettes, afforded a joy incomprehensible to the Western mind. He had a secret spy ring, and it made him very happy, I guess. More especially was this passion to be found in the young women of the country who hitherto had exercised in the service of the czars their talent for secret political intrigue. Catherine the Great had made great use of these northern Aspasias, acting as her unofficial ambassadors and spies, and under Nicholas I, the same organized feminine diplomacy was continued by the political Amazons, whose passions for meddling in the affairs of state absorbed them to the exclusion of all other matters, even love. It is easy to understand that to women of this type, the revolutionary movement should have offered a career even more enticing. To the delights of intrigue were added the charm of novelty and the excitement provided by an element of danger. The young Russian girls with cropped hair, dressed in boyish garments, who crowded to Zurich as students, medical or otherwise, could enjoy all the sensation of an adventure, and on their return to Russia, thousands of men and women, students, went to live in towns and villages to carry on socialistic propaganda amongst the workers.
Now, I'm guessing these were all either Jewish dykes or the naive daughters of elite noblemen.
Well, that's the way it always starts, is the naive children of elite noblemen on an adventure. That's the way it does. Today, I mean, liberalism in America today was led by the naive children of the upper middle class.
Well, they have the time and money to just sit around and chit-chat all day, whereas most normal people, we have to work if we want to eat.
Well, when the Frankfurt School compatriots worked their way into American universities, Columbia, the University of California, at Berkeley, and several others, Brandeis University. When they worked their way into the universities, that they taught their communist, anti-Christian philosophies to not only the Jews that became the revolutionary leaders of the 1960s, like Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and the like, but they also taught those same philosophies to an awful lot of the children of wealthy, middle-class American businessmen.
And people then thought, you have to go to college to be somebody, and we can afford college since we're wealthy, and we worked hard, blah, 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 we're sending you to college, and they just sent their kids to college, and they got a degree in filth.
Well, right, and they became the vanguards of filth.
And they're all professors today, or politicians.
Look at Bill Ayers. He's probably not a Jew. That is the perfect example.
But his parents handed him over to the Jews to educate.
Yes, they did. And his mind is entirely satanized. Instead of being sanitized, it's satanized. No doubt.
It says that he earned a B.A. from the University of Michigan in American Studies.
Well, there we have it. Liberal arts. Liberal arts are our downfall. The Jews took over the entire liberal arts industry in the United States. To play at being peasants has frequently proved a pastime to jaded aristocracy, and Kropotkin, masquerading as, quote, Borodin in a sheepskin, consulted as an oracle by the other sheepskins, evidently found these evenings more entertaining than the dreary formalities of St. Petersburg society. Sounds like the later-day toga parties, right? Mm-hmm. Peter Kropotkin, who may be regarded as the milder type of visionary anarchist, was born in 1842 at Moscow. Although a follower and an ardent admirer of Bakunin, Kropotkin in his private life showed himself greatly superior to his master. Unlike Bakunin, he was a worker, though he not in the sense he implied in his writings to identify himself with the proletariat in such phrases as, quote, we shall succeed in getting our rights respected, unquote, is of course the purest affectation. Kropotkin, who had never worked with his hands but only with his brain, was essentially an aristocrat of the same variety as the aristocrats of France, who before 1789 loved to dilate on the necessity of destroying the existing order.
Well, they're part of the existing order.
Well, absolutely. It's a self-hatred, right? The keynote of all Kropotkin's writings in Unreality, never does he at any point come to grips with life, and it is here he differs from Bakunin. The Russian giant, meaning Bakunin, was a realist, and in advocating revolution, he knew perfectly well what revolution meant. Violence, bloodshed, confusion, chaos, all things in which his soul delighted. On human nature, as we have seen, he entertained no illusions. And it was for war criminals that he expressed his warmest sympathy. Kropotkin, less practical or perhaps less honest, expressed a boundless belief in human nature. A disciple of Rousseau as well as of Weishaupt, there's a dangerous combination, he held that, quote, the inequality of fortunes and conditions, the exploitation of man by man, the domination of the masses by a few, had in the course of ages undermined and destroyed the precious products of the primitive life of society. A passage that might well seem to be taken verbatim from the famous essay on l'inégalité des conditions. The inequality of conditions.
Well, at the same time this was being written, Count Arthur de Goibeneu wrote Les Inégalités de las Races Humaines, and he basically said that inequality was due to the fact that some races were better than other races due to better biology.
Well, right, and that's the school that your icons, Madison, Grant, yeah, you know, that's where he came from mm-hmm. from that same school, that the races simply weren't equal, and they were never going to be equal, right? And but, de Gobineau was a an illustrator of that.
But the progressives, they look at it and they see, oh, everyone must be equal, it's just unequal conditions. So if you take a Chinaman or a Korean and bring him into America, suddenly he'll stop eating cats because now he's an American.
Well, isn't that what the fallen angels have been trying to do for thousands, for 10,000 years, right?
Absolutely. I saw a lost cat sign across from a Chinese restaurant posted on a pole, and I said to my dad, well, if that cat went missing anywhere near that restaurant, I can guarantee you that cat's gone. Some Chinaman ate him.
Well, you know, I don't know if I've repeated the story in a while, but when I moved from Jersey City to Bayonne, I was 16, and there was one Chinese restaurant in town. And by the time I was 30, there were about 30, no exaggeration, maybe 40, storefront Chinese restaurants in Bayonne, New Jersey, a town of 60,000 people. And me and my wife used to walk our dogs at night, and we used to joke about how when we were kids, we always saw tons of stray cats around. But ever since all these Chinese restaurants moved into town, there were no stray cats. They disappeared. All the stray cats and dogs disappeared, I swear. The races can never be equal. The proof of that lies in observing the races in their original non-westernized condition.
Or in the ghettos that they've created here.
Well, yeah, that's true. But you know, here they blame it on white oppression. But nobody white is oppressing the Negro in Kenya.
Exactly. Or they say it's the legacy of post-colonialism. Well, they'll be saying that in another 300 years.
Nobody white is oppressing the Indians on the subcontinent who are living in human cesspools.
Well, the lighter-skinned Indians are oppressing the darker-skinned Indians, who they call untouchables.
Nobody white is oppressing the Chinaman in the rice paddy who hasn't changed his state in 20,000 years.
They would have us believe that we built the ghetto and forced the blacks to live in it. When in actuality, we built the city, they moved in, we moved out, and they turned it into a ghetto.
Well, their aboriginal state shows without a doubt that the races will never be equal. Look at Rome 2,000 years ago and look at Africa today.
Have the blacks ever built a city?
But the liberal, the progressive, never wants to look at it that way. Never wants to look at it objectively. Always wants to look for a culprit.
And it's always the white man.
Always. And it basically boils down to that old, that centuries old, millennia old Genesis 3:15 struggle.
Enmity. The war between the serpent and the woman.
That's the only thing that explains it. And the serpent uses all these other races against the woman. And if we weren't a sinful people, Yahweh wouldn't allow that, us to be tried in that way. That's the bottom line.
We'd know exactly what the score was. We'd see the serpent for what it is.
Yes. With the same wild disregard for truth, Kropotkin echoes Rousseau's panegyrics on the happiness and benevolence of savages, the fraternity and solidarity that distinguishes tribal life, the hospitality of primitive peoples, their respect for human life, compassion for the weak, and personal self-sacrifice, and they should be forced to go live with them. Anybody who echoes these feelings of Kropotkin and Rousseau should be forced to go live with them.
Well, absolutely.
They would be lunch.
That's clearly written by someone that's never seen a black.
Well, that's never observed one close up for a length of time, right? Exactly.
Well, can I go ahead and read a bit from Goibenu?
This is a sick Jewish pipe dream. It's a Jewish fantasy, is exactly where it is.
Goibenu wrote in 1855 here. Let me find what I wanted to read here. Okay. The Negroid variety is the lowest and stands at the foot of the ladder. The animal character that appears in the shape of the pelvis is stamped on the Negro from birth, foreshadowing his destiny. His intellect will always move within a very narrow circle. He is not, however, a mere brute, for behind his low receding brow, in the middle of his skull, we can see signs of a powerful energy, however crude its objects. If his mental faculties are dull or even non-existent, he often has an intensity of desire and so of will, which may be called terrible. Many of his senses, especially taste and smell, are developed to an extent unknown to the other two races. The very strength of his sensation is the most striking proof of his inferiority. All food is good in his eyes. Nothing disgusts or repels him. What he desires is to eat furiously and to excess. No carrion is too revolting to be swallowed by him. It is the same with odors. His inordinate desires are satisfied with all, however, coarse or even horrible. To these qualities may be added an instability and capriciousness of feelings that cannot be tied down to any single object, in which, so far as he is concerned, do away with all distinctions of good and evil. We might even say that the violence with which he pursues the object that has aroused his senses and inflamed his desire is a guarantee of the desires soon being satisfied and the object forgotten. Finally, he is equally careless of his own life and the lives of others. He kills willingly for the sake of killing, and this human machine, in whom it is so easy to arouse emotion, shows in the face of suffering either a monstrous indifference or a cowardice that seeks a voluntary refuge in death. Wouldn't you say that's a much more adequate description? Or accurate, I should say?
Well, absolutely. It's a lot more accurate than Rousseau's, what's basically a fantasy, because that's what this is. It's a fantasy.
And then
it's
Goibin,
not based one bit on any fact at all.
Goibinu cites accounts given by explorers in Africa. He then goes on to cite accounts of cranial capacity with the skulls being stuffed up and filled with grains. And Rousseau cites nothing other than his own fantasy. But self-sacrifice is not a quality inherent in the Negro. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
Human sacrifice is a quality.
It's never going to happen. I've never once observed it.
Maybe child sacrifice instead of self-sacrifice.
Yeah, that's incredible.
The respect for human life. I mean, they'll cut your throat for your cell phone.
No doubt. They'll cut your fingers off for your rings or for your wristwatch. They'd rather cut your hand off rather than just take the time to take your watch off.
So whoever wrote this, they should be made to live in the deepest heart of darkest Africa. They should be sent to the Congo.
Or at least to a federal prison for a few months, just to get the experience.
Well, okay. There they'd have a few white people to stick up for them in prison, wouldn't they? There wouldn't be anyone in the Congo. Except idiot missionaries.
Kropotkin's idol, Marat, himself could not have written a more direct incentive to violence, and when we consider that he was one of the leading members of the Tchaikovsky Circle, and that this was the kind of propaganda the band of heroic missionaries was engaged in carrying out amongst the people from 1872 onwards, we cannot wonder that the government again saw fit to intervene. 37 provinces, a government circular declared, had been infected by the socialist contagion, and in 1878, wholesale arrests were ordered. Then the vicious circle...
Did you skip a page or something?
I don't think so.
I thought you missed a paragraph right after personal self-sacrifice. The paragraph arriving inevitably at the same conclusion as Weishaupt, Kropotkin argues that human nature, being so inherently benign, all restraint should be removed, all law and government abolished. Even murderers should go unpunished, and criminals should, quote, be soothed with fraternal care.
Well, why don't you pick it up?
Okay. So identical are many of these theories with those of Weishaupt that it is impossible not to believe that, like Bakunin, he had fallen under the spell of Illuminism and was consciously working for the sect that had as its object, quote, the universal revolution which should deal the death blow to society. And that's what all Jews want. Weishaupt's not simply being influenced by Illuminism or anything like that. He's a Jew. He's been influenced by Satan in his DNA.
Well, right. And he was a Jesuit, and he was the inspiration of Illuminism.
The connection between all the succeeding disciples of Weishaupt can only be established by comparing their writings, when it will become evident that passages so closely resembling each other cannot be attributed to mere coincidence. Or we could just say that they all read the exact same Talmud. And the main ideas of world revolution will be seen to descend in unbroken sequence from one revolutionary group to another. Indeed, Kropotkin himself informs us that between the Alliance Social-Democratique of Bakunin and the secret societies of 1795, there was a direct affiliation. If then, nihilism was working in conjunction with Bakunin's associations, and we cannot doubt it, it is easy to see how the theories of the Philadelphs percolated to the Tchaikovsky circle. It is thus that in Kropotkin's Parols de une Revolt, where more than in any other of his writings, his program of revolution is set forth, we seem to hear again the voice of that earlier Illuminatist, Graucus Bauboof, member of the Philadelphs and the continuer of the plan of Weishaupt. So Kropotkin is writing in French to a French audience, presumably while he's in France. He has to be a Jew. How many white people go to another country and tell another people that they should rise up and destroy the established order in their country? Most white people are just focused on trying to get by and make an honest living. And they don't have the resources to travel abroad for the purpose of instigating revolution. I mean, can you name for me a single white that we would consider a professional revolutionary?
No, not unless they're 60s whores for the Jews. Patty Hearst isn't an actual revolutionary. She's just a whore and a follower.
Absolutely.
And that's the first example that comes to mind.
Sure. Although not a communist like Bauboof, Kropotkin advocates, for example, the same system of trade by barter. Quote, "Do you wish tools and machinery?" he asks the peasants. "You will come to an understanding with the workers of the towns, who will send them to you in exchange for your products." Well, they're just interfering with the natural process then, aren't they? Since the people, if left to their own devices, would do this on their own if they felt it would benefit them. They're just becoming the head honcho, saying, here's how it's going to be, and we're going to tax it. We're going to control it. It's just the Jewish middleman all throughout history, be it a capitalist middleman taxing you or the communist middleman taxing you. And we are seriously asked to imagine life conducted by means of this continual weighing upon of values, the peasants requiring a scythe, dispatching to the town a sitting of turkeys' eggs, and the worth being deemed insufficient, receiving in exchange a chisel, which does not happen to want. Not merely in Parilliots. Did I butcher that?
Not merely in
Parilliots.
Parilliots.
Okay.
Which are childish statements.
Oh, okay.
It comes from a Latin word that means a boy, right?
Oh, okay, certainly. Such as these does Kropotkin continue the tradition of Bauboof, but also in the organization of the coming revolution. Bauboof, it will be remembered, was the first to preach the great day of the people, the day whereupon the maddened multitude should fling itself upon all wealth and property as the preliminary to communism. This simple and expeditious method, long since abandoned by the communists in favor of the gradual acquisition of political power, and that's the plan that they did in this country and that they've implemented and achieved in this country, the gradual route, was now revived by the anarchists with the object of inaugurating their rival system. And thus, in his chapter on expropriation, we find Kropotkin reproducing almost verbatim the old program of Bauboof. Well, anarchism was never genuine, was it? They never intended a stateless society with no central government. Anarchy
Absolutely
was just a lie.
Not. They only wanted to remove the white Christian government and replace it with a Jewish Talmudic government, just like they did in Russia in 1917. Because the Talmud dictates that Jews should be the holders of all property, that all the property of the Goyim belongs to the Jew. So communism is the practice of Talmudic economics.
It's the implementation of what the Talmud calls for, the seizing of the property of the Goyim.
Well, the proof of that again lies in the Yeltsin administration in the 1990s in the former Soviet Union, right? Where the Jews ended up as the property holders of all the state industry that formerly belonged to the Russian people. So communism did exactly what it was supposed to do. It's the economic manifestation of Talmudism. The Jew ends up with all the property.
Well, I forget which author it was who wrote that communism is the means by which the Jew takes your country away from you. That's why there's no communism in Israel. There is no communism in Israel, is there? The Jew doesn't need it.
No doubt. The Jew doesn't need it in Israel. Israel is a haven for crooks and criminals, just like Adolf Hitler said it would be. The Jew takes all the property back to Israel and collects it there. That's the nest he's feathering.
General expropriation alone, writes Kropotkin, can satisfy the multitude of sufferers and oppressed. From the domain of theory, they must be made to enter that of practice. But in order that expropriation should answer to its principle, which is to suppress all private property and to give back all to all, it must be accomplished on a vast scale. On a small scale, we should see nothing but vulgar pillage. On a large one, it is the beginning of social reorganization. Well, on a national scale, all we see is the Jewish pillage of the entire nation. It's just pillage times 1,000. We've never seen any giving back all to all. And how can you give back my car to someone else? It's my car. We can't give back your house to a guy that lives 2 towns over because it's not his house. He never owned it. So this is all just, it's rhetoric, empty rhetoric. The idea that no one can own everything and everything belongs to everyone. But although Bakunin had declared that robbery was one of the most honorable forms of Russian national life, and that he who does not understand robbery can understand nothing in the history of the Russian masses, it appears that the plan of laying violent hands on all property was one to which the people could not be expected yet to rise.
And that's how Stalin went from train robber to the leader of all Russia.
He had an honorable profession robbing trains and banks. And in most countries, wouldn't that be a capital offense if you rob enough trains and banks? They would just hang you?
Well, I don't think you have to rob a whole lot to get hung in most Western countries.
So the Tsar really couldn't have been a bloodthirsty tyrant if Stalin got away with robbing trains for years.
Well, absolutely. Russia was, I think we saw that, it only had 5,000 cops before the 1917 revolution.
For the largest country in terms of land size, and at the time it probably had the largest population at around 50 to 70 million. And I guarantee you, there are more than 5,000 police in New York City alone.
No. There's about 45,000 police in New York City.
And there's only
5,000 just in the subway.
And how many people live in New York City?
7.5 million that they count.
And does anyone call the mayor a bloodthirsty tyrant and demand blood in the
street? Well, no, because he's a Jew. Who would call a Jew a bloodthirsty tyrant today? You'd be an anti-Semite, right? You'd be run out of the country.
But if a white leader had 45,000 police in a city of several million, they'd be calling for an overthrow of the system, saying he's a bloodthirsty tyrant, it's a police state, anarchy, 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 burn,
absolutely.
Burn, burn.
No doubt. Jewish hypocrisy. White people don't see it.
It would be a fatal error, Kropotkin observes regretfully, to believe that the idea of expropriation has yet penetrated into the minds of all the workers and become one of those convictions for which an upright man is ready to sacrifice his life. Far from it. And he goes on to explain the necessity of educating the people up to this sublime ideal. What that means is the common man's not yet ready to die so the Jew can have someone else's land. In order to persuade the Russian peasants to emulate those of France in the preceding century by seizing social riches, we, revolutionary socialists, he writes, must work incessantly from this moment to disseminate the ideas of expropriation by all our words and all our acts. Let the word expropriation penetrate into every commune of the country. Let it be discussed in every village and become for every workman and every peasant an integral part of the word anarchy. And then, only then, we shall be sure that on the day of the revolution it will be on all lips, that it will rise formidable, backed by the whole people, and that the blood of the people will not have flowed in vain. Well, he says they're going to lead by example. How many Jews lead from the front in these revolutions? They hang behind in case things don't go so well and they need to flee.
Well, absolutely. They're clerks, right?
Absolutely. And if the revolution fails, they all just come to America or Britain and they become professors. Kropotkin's idol, Marat, himself could not have written a more direct incentive to violence. And when we consider that he was one of the leading members of the Tchaikovsky Circle, and that this was the kind of propaganda the band of heroic missionaries was engaged in carrying out amongst the people from 1872 onwards, we cannot wonder that the government again saw fit to intervene. Now, in most countries, if we were sitting around in a coffee house in America urging the people to rise up and cut the throats of senators and set off bombs in the street, Wouldn't we? We'd all be in what is it? ADX Florence in Colorado, that supermax prison.
Absolutely. We wouldn't be like Bill Ayers teaching our children in the University of Chicago or wherever he is.
They wouldn't make a movie about the life of Sword Brethren, would they?
No.
We'd all be doing 30 years on conspiracy. 37 okay. provinces, a government circular declared, had been infected by the socialist contagion, and in 1878, wholesale arrests were ordered. Then the vicious circle began again. A propagandist, Bugeljabouf, was couched by the police, and a woman revolutionary, Vera Sasilich, retaliated by attempting to shoot Trepov, the prefect of police in St. Petersburg. Sasilich, and I'm sure that's from Sassoon, she's a Jew, she has to be a Jew, with the name Vera Sasilich. Vera means truth, doesn't it?
In Latin, right.
Only a hypocritical Jew would take the name truth.
It seems to come from the word veritas.
Hmm. Sasilich was acquitted, but Kowalski, the leader of the band of revolutionaries in Odessa, was shot. He has to be a Jew named Kowalski in Odessa. And in revenge, Mesentsev, head of the third section, was murdered by Kravinsky, alias Stepniak, on the Nevsky Prospect. So basically, Jews get killed in revolutionary acts trying to kill police, and they retaliate by murdering other police.
And Vera Sasilich was acquitted by a jury.
And if this was the 1960s, they'd be planting bombs under the squad cars instead of shooting at the police or throwing, satchels at carriages. Then followed a series of attempts on the life of Alexander II. She was acquitted, so she had a trial. It wasn't just dragging out in the woods and shooting in the back of the head. So really, who's the tyrant here? The Lenin government, the Stalin government, or the Tsar? When the Jews are in power, the blood's going to flow. Then followed a series of attempts on the life of Alexander II. In September 1879, the conspirators, led by Sophie Perovskaya and Leo Hartmann, he sounds like a genuine Russian, formed a plan to blow up the imperial train just outside Moscow, but only succeeded in destroying a train which did not contain the emperor. I guess that's collateral damage. They would call that collateral damage.
Vera Sasilich is only coming up in one book. But I can't get a grip on who she is from any of it. There's about a dozen hits, but none of them are telling me exactly who she is. It's going to remain a mystery for now.
All right. In the following year, two other terrorists, Halterin and Shelabov, succeeded in exploding a charge of dynamite beneath the dining room of the Winter Palace. But again, the emperor escaped without injury. Now, how much of a tyrant can he be if you can even approach his palace? I don't even think you can walk within a block or two of the White House today, can you?
No, you'll they have it all fenced off. You can't. I mean, every time somebody tries to jump over the fence, he gets tackled by squadrons of Secret Service agents. And
they haul you off to who knows where.
Hauled off to the nut house or something, right?
Meanwhile, Alexander II, with a newly appointed minister, Count Loris Melikov, continued to work out plans for reform. Melikov, whatever his shortcomings might be, was a man of far more liberal tendencies than his predecessors, and indeed we find a Finnish writer declaring that some of the measures adopted by him should have shown to every thoughtful person that he was planning the introduction of far-reaching reforms which might perhaps have led to regeneration of Russia, the regeneration of Russia, end quote. But the Jews aren't interested in national regeneration or any talk of reforms. They don't want reforms. As Maurice Samuel said, nothing you do can satisfy our demands because we want a world of our own.
It seems to me that Webster is buying a lot of the Jewish propaganda about the economic state of Russia,
mm-hmm.
because Russia is clearly one of the most productive industrialized nations of Europe at this time.
Mm-hmm. Whether this is so or not, it is certain that Loris Melikov was largely instrumental in deciding the emperor to convoke an advisory assembly on the question of reforms. And more important, it was Melikov who finally, on the 2nd of March, 1881, laid before him the plan of a constitution. Are we to believe that, as has been already suggested, the word constitution was the rallying cry of the secret societies? We have seen that in the French Revolution, both the framing of the Constitution in 1789 and its acceptance by the kings in 1791 became the signals for fresh outbreaks of revolutionary fury. We have seen the Decembrist outbreak of 1825 in Russia, led by the same war cry, and now again in Russia of 1881, the same strange phenomenon occurs. No sooner had Melikov embarked on his career of reforms than an attempt had been made to murder him, and on the very day that Alexander II signed the Constitution, he was cut down by the hand of an assassin. Well, you can't negotiate with evil. The Jews are not interested in reform, are they? They just want to kill, tear down, and destroy. Even Prince Kropotkin is obliged to recognize the emperor's courage and noble self-sacrifice at that supreme moment when, at a signal from Sophie Petrovskaya, a bomb was thrown at the imperial carriage as it passed along the road by the Catherine Canal. Only the mounted Cossacks surrounding it received any injuries, and the coachman urged the Tsar to follow him to allow him to drive on out of danger. But Alexander refused to leave his followers to their fate and deliberately went forth to meet his death. Now, wasn't this the woman who was acquitted before? I guess she's just an upright citizen who didn't deserve to go to prison.
No, Sophie Petrovskaya is somebody else.
Oh, okay.
You're thinking about Zira Saskatchewan. Or
okay.
Sorry, I forgot her last name.
Zira
Sasilich.
As he walked towards the wounded and dying Cossacks lying in the snow beside his carriage, a second assassin, with inconceivable cowardice, threw another bomb, and this time Alexander fell, mortally wounded. The same night, the draft of the Constitution bearing the Emperor's signature was torn into 100 fragments by one of his son's advisors. So ended for the moment all hope of reform in Russia. Inevitable reaction followed on this dastardly crime. The conspirators, Shebelov, Rysakov, Sophie Petrovskaya, and two others were put to death, it is said, with fearful cruelty. Well, it seems in Russia the only thing you can do to get executed is to kill the leader. In America, how many capital offenses do we have today? Several dozen?
Yes.
If they can show that you're the head of a drug kingpin, you know, if you're a drug kingpin heading up a cartel, they can execute you, can't they?
Well, there are a lot more capital offenses than there were in Russia. This is a pharisaical state today.
But you can be a Negro gang rapist, and you'll get three hots and a cot for maybe a few years, and then it'll set you loose.
As long as you're raping a white woman.
Certainly. That one judge in France gave one Negro rapist, he said, I'm going to throw the book at you. You're getting 1 year for every woman, so he got 17 years in prison.
Big deal.
Big deal. In Somalia, he'd be on the menu, so being in prison in France, it's a hotel to him. But though we must execrate these barbarous methods of retaliation, we must surely admit that brutality was to be found on both sides. If we pity the so-called martyrs of imperial despotism, may we not also ask what pity had these men and women felt for their victims, not only for the agents of despotism they set out to destroy, but for the innocent men of the people sacrificed with them? What regard had they shown for human life in their attempts to wreck the imperial train? What of the engine driver and other employees involved in the disaster? What of the many people actually killed and wounded in this attempt that miscarried? What of the 30 soldiers on duty who perished in the explosion at the Winter Palace? Let us pity then the martyrs whose tortures no circumstances can justify, but let us reserve some pity for those humble and forgotten victims whom no revolutionary writer seems to consider of the slightest consequence. Well, the Jews don't consider goyim to be of any consequence, do they? It's no offense to murder us.
Well, right. It's absolute hypocrisy that nobody realizes. When you're an ex-Hollywood movie director and you've debauched a string of 13-year-old girls and you're about to get extradited, the Jews jump up and down and scream. But when you draw a swastika on a synagogue, or if you burn a cross on a Negro's lawn, you're going away for 10 years.
And most of that they do themselves. They paint swastikas on their own synagogues, and they're usually backward swastikas.
Well, they do that to raise funds.
And she doesn't even get into addressing the issue that the Tsar fundamentally did not deserve to die, so why don't we pity the Tsar? Because he was cruelly struck down by cowards.
Well, she's being tongue-in-cheek here. by saying, let us pity then the martyrs,
mm-hmm.
whose tortures no circumstances can justify.
Well, they should have been flayed alive.
Absolutely. They should have been hung in the public square until buzzards ate their remains as an example to all future Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, look at my hero in history is Vlad the Impaler. He took the Jews and the Turks coming into Romania to pollute Romania, and he hung them on stakes along the road.
Mm-hmm.
I would do the same thing at the Mexican border.
That lets them know you're not welcome here.
Absolutely.
What was it that Zinoviev wrote when Yuritsky was assassinated by some crazy coffeehouse Jew who didn't like him, that the bourgeois must pay with blood, as much blood as possible?
Right, and it was a Jew that tried the tried the attempt, right?
Well, wasn't Yuritsky killed?
Yes, Yuritsky was killed. I'm thinking about the Jew that tried to attempt on Trotsky or Lenin.
Mm. In 1878, Western Europe experienced a repercussion of the Russian terror. They should probably call it the Jewish terror. And the four leading anarchists, Kropotkin, Cafiero, Malatesta, and Brusa, organized a worldwide scheme of violence described by them as the propaganda of the deed, which found its first expression in an attempt on the life of King Humbert of Italy. This outrage was followed by two attempts of the same kind directed against the Emperor Wilhelm I of Germany. If we are to believe socialist writers, neither Hodel nor Dr. Karl Nobeling, who within a month fired at the Emperor in Berlin, had any conviction with the socialist or anarchist movement, but served simply as a pretext for the anti-socialist law which Bismarck passed triumphantly at the end of the year. This would be quite in keeping with German imperial policy, which had always consisted in crushing at home the subversive forces it used so freely abroad. It didn't use any subversive forces abroad. Those were Jews with German passports.
Right, but Webster never makes that distinction, and that's her biggest failure.
It is quite possible that a half-witted youth such as Hodel, with photographs of the leading socialists, Liebknecht and Bebel, that sounds a lot like Babel, as in Babylon, placed in his pockets by the Berlin police, may have been hired for the deed. Agent provocateurs are, of course, a favorite resource of autocratic governments.
Well, Webster will point out that it's Jews who are behind all of these intrigues, but then she'll insist on calling them Germans or Russians or Italians.
Sure, just because they have passports from Italy or Germany. Bismarck was thus able to nip in the bud not only socialism but anarchy, which in the person of Johann most threatened to become a danger. Germany itself, as Zenker observes, may be termed the most free from anarchists of any country in Europe. The genius of the German people is naturally disinclined to individualism, and whether in the form of Prussian militarism or of state socialism, always favors mass formation. It was thus by the social democrats themselves that most was finally expelled. It will be noticed that whenever agitators threaten seriously to disturb the peace in Germany, they are either summarily suppressed or used for export, preferably to England. More likely, they're kicked out of the country and the only way they can go is England. Whether in accordance with this plan or on his own initiative, Most came to London in 1879, where he organized a society called the Unified Socialists on the principles of Marx's Communist Manifesto, and having for its motto the Marxian battle cry, "Workers of all countries unite." At the same time, he founded a secret organization under the name of the Propagandist Club, with a view to preparing the General Revolution. Yet in London, he found an even less fruitful field for his labors than in Berlin. England, the ancient refuge of political offenders, wrote Zenker in 1895, although it has sheltered Bakunin, Kropotkin, Reclus, Most, Penckert, Louis Michel, Cafiero, Malatesta, and other anarchist leaders, and still shelters some of them, although London is rich in anarchist clubs and newspapers, meetings and congresses, yet possesses no anarchism, native to the soil.
Well, what that tells me is what? What does that tell you?
There's not a large Jewish community there. The people don't want it.
No, there is a large Jewish community there, and they're using these anarchists to foment the revolution on the continent. They're whores for the Rothschilds, every one of them. They're pawns of the Rothschilds.
So they're using Britain as the base of operations, which is why they don't want any instability in Britain.
And not even Webster is seeing that. That's the only thing that explains this to me.
All right. Yet possesses no anarchism native to the soil, and has formed at all times merely a kind of exchange or marketplace for anarchist ideas, motive, forces, and the literature of agitation. London is especially the headquarters of German anarchism, read Jews from Germany. The English working classes have, however, always regarded their ideas very coldly, while the government have always regarded the eccentric proceedings of the anarchists, as long as they confine themselves merely to talking or writing, in the most logical spirit of the doctrine of laissez-faire. Indeed, so sturdy was the resistance offered by British labor to Most's doctrines that when he endeavored to publish his paper, Freedom, no printer could be found to set up the type. I guess Troublemaker would say that he was being censored, even though people were just exercising their freedom to tell him, we don't want your business.
Right.
But he was technically free to go form his own printing press, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
He's just not free to force himself on someone else's printing press. No,
nobody wanted a part of it. And I believe, you know, it might be conjectural at this point on my part, but I think that the Rothschilds were ultimately responsible for most of the socialist agitation in Russia. Mm-hmm. And that's, we see the Jewish hand in Europe, and we see who holds all the property today, and we see who holds the political control today. The ends proves the means.
Alas, with the spread of education, such obstacles have long since been removed. Now his doctrines don't need to be printed in their own papers. He just puts them in a textbook, and all the kids have to read it in school.
Right, and we're not going to finish this chapter today, so why don't we just end this here until next week?
All right, certainly. Do you have any closing thoughts, sir?
No, I just gave them that I believe that London was the haven for these people, and that was by design.
And now we're the new London, basically.
Well, we have been for 100 years, right?
Exactly. The Rothschild base of power is basically the United States. The United States is the Jewish playground, isn't it?
Well, it has been for 100 years. China's the next Jewish playground. They're going to try to hop the Pacific, and it's not going to work.
They won't have any white women to amuse themselves with over in China, though, will they?
Well, if they want to bring them from the Ukraine, they might.
All right, so we'll pick up next weekend, then.
Praise
All right, yeah, thank you. Yahweh bless.